Oh, just as lucky that my
yes.
Is someone going to operate the slides for you?
I'm going to do that.
Okay. Give some air, doesn't it?
Hi. My name is Scott Schwager, and I'm a member of the Arts Club and a director on the board here. I want to welcome you all this evening, and thank you very much for coming to hear tonight's Monday talk, which is by Professor Eve Middleton Kelly and Michael Petri. You'll probably know from the program, but let me tell you anyway that Professor Eve Middleton Kelly at LSE is the director of Complexity Research Program. And Michael Petri is an artist, and he's also curator of the Royal Academy School's gallery. Michael's also written two books, which are available. He's the author of Installation Art for Thames, published with Thames and Hudson, and also Installation in the New Millennium. I may have dropped a couple words from those titles, but that's the general idea. Anyway, Professor Eve Middleton Kelly will tell us more about the talk, but in general, she'll be speaking about how complexity theory can help us understand some aspects of art and creativity. And then Michael will be speaking about the contribution art can make to complexity theory, and hopefully it will be very participatory. And if you're interested afterwards to receive invitations for those who aren't members of the club, there's a piece of paper where you could put your name and email if, for example, you knew them. And if you're interested to join the club, Ian Palmer, who's the general manager of the club, has left some of his cards on top of some application forms. We could arrange for him to give you a tour at your leisure and speak to you more about that. Also, if you're interested to stay for dinner, will anybody stay for a dinner or a drink afterwards? If anybody's interested to join them for dinner, that would be lovely as well. So without further ado, welcome. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Oh, well, I'm absolutely delighted, actually, that this has finally happened, because we've been talking about it for so long, and eventually we managed to find a date. Let me explain very briefly how the evening will go. Michael, first of all, will tell you about two other installations that we have set up in two complexity conferences. And then I will introduce some of the concepts of complexity theory so that we can really think about how can these concepts actually help us to think about art. I will then open a discussion between the two of us, with Michael saying a little bit about how art, as he's an artist, can help us to think about the theory, and then open it to everyone. But at any point, we want this to be very, very interactive. So if you don't understand what we're saying, please put the hand up and we'll take it. So informal and interactive is the way that we like it. So Michael, would you like to tell us about the...
See, Eve didn't have to duck.
Advantages of being short.
This is a project that is an ongoing project called Superstring Installation. And it's based on another scientific principle, which is what are called superstrings. For those of you who don't know, it's at the moment considered to be the smallest particles in the universe. So we used to have atoms. We used to have molecules, and we had atoms being smaller, and then atoms were broken up into their subatomic particles, protons, neutrons, electrons, and then there were quarks, and we're now at superstrings. And superstrings, in a very kind of simple way, are said to be such small connective bits of matter and energy that they're going through us all the time. And they're so uninteractive that we don't notice. So like a neutrino is something that's, we're being bombarded with neutrinos all the time. they don't interact with this. So the mathematical model for superstrings are something very similar to this wire, this elastic. Instead of it being exactly string, it's a piece of elastic that's wound with string. And that is how the superstrings are conceptually visualized. And it's very important we're talking about the visualization of mathematical concepts here, because in a way that's where art often does come into play for science, because we're trying to visualize very, very complex eighth dimensional mathematical models. When I was asked by Eve to participate in a project on complexity after I had some initial tutelage from Eve, I realized that this was a way that we could actually model two things at the same time and still make an artwork, because it also is an experiment in complexity as we make it. Because what happens is that the artwork emerges, which is one of the core notions of complexity, where things emerge from certain systems, where this object comes about without me or you, without someone telling you how to do it. It comes about through the cooperation of all the participants in the project. It's called a self-organizing principle. And so we've self-organized this kind of huge spiderweb. Now we've just for us this is really just the very starting point. The images I'm going to show you are from a two-day conference. The first ones are from a two-day conference in Turin, where it was continuously being added to and changed by about 100 people, and so it got really crazy. You can sort of see up at the top where the blue sky is, you start to see some of the lines. But I mean, it's incredibly difficult to photograph this because obviously with these very thin strings, you don't see it as well as when you're in it. And as you see here, this is over the main area. It became incredibly dense and it kept changing. It would go horizontally, it would go vertically. And as people were paying attention or not paying attention, they'd run into it, pieces would break and would fall down. And people would put airplanes, actually that's a new one. Airplanes is a new one. And the speakers would get actually caught up in the actual pieces. And what was really nice, because it was, we had given everyone permission to continuously put string as whenever they wanted. People were even putting string up even as people were talking. So they'd be talking, they were pretty careful about it, but then all of a sudden they'd get sort of trapped into a space. And so it was a very kind of nice initial model of a complex system. And then it was an ever-changing installation. And you're getting kind of the bare bones of it, but you can imagine how beautiful this would look if everybody kept working at it, because it just becomes this incredible three-dimensional spider web that's connecting without any of us making an overall decision. So as you see, that you get all these intersections that are coming about where someone says, oh, I actually will put it over or under. And so it creates this web, which I don't have any control of other than to give you a very simple rule, which is to connect two points in space in the room. And that's all anyone's done. But at the same time, already we've got this very complex structure that has come out of that incredibly simple rule.
But, sorry to interrupt, but isn't there has been an overall decision, because almost everyone has decided to make it at the same level, and doesn't group mentality play a massive part in it?
We've got one here. I mean, a lady just put one down there at the back at table level. So, I mean, as more people, I mean, this was just the start, as I was saying. When you get a start, it does maybe take on a certain level, but very quickly, as people do it over time, I can show you a few more images. I mean, literally, people were getting on chairs and taking them from the ceiling to the floor. In places that, were all over the place. I mean, as long as you don't say anything is wrong. I mean, putting the airplane isn't wrong.
But I think even if you say that nothing's wrong, people prefer to stick to the same thing as this in place, because it's all very much uniform.
Well, I
there's
think
there's only a few variations.
I think for a start, I mean, we've done it for 10 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, it's very hard for people to actually engage with it in 10 minutes. I mean, this, as I say, took place over 2 days. And I think at first, maybe you're right. I don't remember exactly how whether it all started at one level, but certainly by the end, it was completely, it was very difficult to get in and out of.
Yeah.
And there was a situation which was amusing in that there was a professor who is one of the leading superstring theorists, and he's Italian, and he's in a wheelchair. He's rather old and very cranky, and he was put. There was a dais, and he was wheeled to the dais before the lunch because that way he was ready after the lunch to speak. And nobody decided what to do or not. But he then started to say that in a very rude way to the other scientists, much less the artists, that he thought none of them were smart enough to really understand superstring theory, and that he thought it was a big waste of his time to actually try to explain to us dullards what superstring theory really was. And the other scientists were really less happy about that, but they all broke into laughter when he went to leave the stage, and he couldn't because he'd actually been somehow trapped in the web, because people had done it and they were putting it on the floor and all of this. And so when he an hour earlier had been wheeled up, there was a clear path. So you can imagine, at least on that level, there was a clear path. But within an hour, it was so difficult that he was actually trapped up there. We had to cut through the pieces so he could get down. So no, actually, people really did. And again, we never said go high, low, or anything. People just chose where they would put them. For the second version, we wanted to add another layer to it. And so this was in Calabria, and I literally called in the instructions over the phone. So I wasn't even there to physically oversee it. And we wanted to see what would happen when those instructions were relayed with another level of distance. And again, you see, they put it on the floor. You can see it, where the white tape is. Normally we use white and black tape, so people also have a choice of kind of binary decision in terms of color decision. Here we've had to use blue tack just because we can't put on a tape on these walls or rip the paper off. There's loads of them on the floor, and that's again from a very early starting position, this image, and then, as you see there, they also got incredibly wrapped up in the piece. I think that's really a very anti-group mentality, to literally go across a speaker and tie them in. And so it was, and the speakers had to, everyone had to understand that whatever emerged was perfectly fine, and that nobody got to say, no, stop, you can't do that. The other thing is, this is really, it doesn't hurt you. You can run into it. It's very unaggressive. But again, here we look, there. I was told they were actually throwing it over that metal thing at the top. That's why they got it up so high. And again, that's an incredibly adventurous activity, to actually take something and throw it, in a kind of conference setting. I think very quickly people lost their inhibition and the group mentality sort of thing disappeared. Okay, so I think, because we're short on time, I'm gonna, if you can ask me questions about that afterwards, but I'm gonna hand over to Eve now. But I just wanted you to get an idea of what we were trying to do here with this, and give you a notion that if it were to carry on, we would hopefully get an even more complicated structure that would emerge.
Okay. I would like now to again come back to you and ask you, you've heard a couple of things that Michael described in terms of some of the characteristics of complexity theory, like emergence and self-organization and so on. But can I ask you, you came here today probably because you were in some way interested to find out a little more about this thing called complexity theory. So what does it mean to you? Just give me a word or a phrase of what does it mean to you.
Connections between science and art.
Okay, connection. And you qualified it between science and art. Okay, connection is the key thing. Thank you. Any other?
I was coming to be taught what complexity theory was. I haven't heard a definition of it yet.
Okay.
So I was
does
hoping
it mean
someone
anything
would
to
just
you?
Say what it actually was.
That's what I hope to be able to explain in the next 15, 20 minutes. But what does it mean to you? I mean,
don't
you
know
yet.
I don't know. I'm waiting to be told.
Okay.
I think nature.
Nature?
Yes.
Okay. Right.
Complication.
Yes.
Patterns.
Patterns. Excellent. I like that. Yes.
What it means to different people, the same thing. What does it actually mean? I mean, I might think one thing, but the person over there might think something else. Are we both wrong or are we both right? What does it mean?
So are you saying that it has that perspectives vary, or that there are multiple perspectives?
There are multiple.
Yes, absolutely. Multiple perspectives is very much part of it. Okay.
To do with making sense of the world?
Yes.
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 And does this apply things that are both random and structured?
Absolutely. That's good. Okay. Anything else? Come on, Julie. You must. Okay. Well, that's a good start. So let me begin with connection, because connectivity is very much part of it. What complex systems they manifest themselves through connectivity and interdependence. In other words, the way that we relate with each other, the way that we are connected with each other, it's that relationship which creates complex behavior. So complex behavior arises from connectivity, from relationship. Now, one of the things that is important, and is part of making sense of the world, is that a lot of the scientific emphasis in the past centuries has been in actually looking at entities themselves, pulling them apart into their smallest constituents, and then putting them together again. Now, what complexity looks at is the relationship between the parts of the entities and between entities themselves. I say entities because it applies to everything that has the possibility to relate. So it's part of the natural world, obviously part of the biological world, part of the human world. So at all aspects, the relationship exists. Now, what happens when we have these interactions and these relationships? Now, as this is one example. When they were just pieces of string by themselves, they would not have been very much, particularly if, as you say, we were all doing them in an identical way and perhaps they were just in parallel lines or whatever. But if you notice, there are some very, very interesting patterns that have emerged. Now, that's one of the concepts that Michael actually mentioned, and it's one very important principle of how complex systems actually behave and operate. Now, what is important about emergence is that through interaction, behaviors arise that are not predictable at the outset. and create patterns that again are not predictable. So this pattern, even though we could have predicted that some pattern would be created, there was no way that anyone could have predicted the precise configuration of this pattern. So this pattern is emergent. It is not predictable. Now, another interesting aspect of emergence is that it is what is called a systemic property. In other words, it is people working together that create it. So that is why it is essential to understand that it is part of relating, part of working together, part of interacting. Because, let me give you an example. If how many of you have taken part in a brainstorming session? Quite a few. Okay, now what happened at the during that process is that new ideas came through, emerged, but which were triggered through that interaction. It was the group working together that created it. If these individuals were put in separate cells and asked to think about the issue or the problem or whatever, they would never have come up with the same result. So what I'm trying to explain here is that it is through the interaction, interacting together as a group, as a system, that these ideas emerge. And that if we were to separate these people individually, without the interaction, the same ideas would not have come about. What I'm trying to do by giving you some practical examples is to say these ideas, this theory, is not just, does not exist only at the theoretical level, because we use it in a very practical way. And in fact, we work with a lot of organizations in both the private and public sector addressing what we call apparently intractable problems. These are very complex problems that appear not to be, not to have any kind of solution, and usually it's because they are addressed in the wrong way. They are addressed in a very linear way. They're addressed in a way that actually focuses on a single dimension, when a complex problem, a complex system, is multidimensional. So not only do we have multiple perspectives, we also have multiple dimensions, in the sense that if we talk about any kind of human system or human problem, it would have a social, a cultural, a political, an economic, a physical, a technical dimension or aspect to it. And if we focused exclusively on one area, then that we cannot actually resolve it, because we are approaching something which is very complex, which has multiple dimensions in only one way. But let us come back now a little to the art side. Now, when anyone has a very difficult problem, when an artist is trying to create a work, part of the process of creation is not only allowing this emergence to come through, because very few artists can actually predict precisely what the work of art will be like at the end. They may have a conception at the beginning, but is that correct, Michael?
Yeah,
but the precise way that it will come out cannot be predicted at the outset. But there's something else which is very important here, which is part of the creative process is that the artist explores what we call the space of possibilities, explores different alternatives, different options. Now, imagine what would happen. You're coming here tonight. You know you need to be here by 7 o'clock, and the road you normally take that you know very well is blocked. What will you do? Exactly. You will try and find some kind of alternative. I mean, one of your options is to say, too difficult, too long, I'll go home. So that's one option. But usually, when we have such a constraint, we actually do try to explore what are the options, what are the alternatives. And we do that constantly in everyday life. An artist does it methodically. They do it as part of that process of creation, that they are trying to very specifically explore different options. And as I said, that's part of the creative process. Another aspect which you've captured here in terms of random and structured is that from what may appear to be a random distribution of elements or ideas, there comes a point where we can actually see pattern or structure. Now, what happens there is that the system goes through what is called a phase transition. It goes from something which is totally random to actually having order, having structure, having a pattern. Now, in some cases, it is when we as humans make sense of it and actually read a pattern into it. Sometimes these patterns may not be objective, and we may see different patterns because we can have multiple perspectives. And we usually do see complex problems from very different points of view. And one of the things we always do is to actually listen to the different perspectives, particularly when looking at a very complex problem, because it is very rarely that there is one point of view in it, and only when you listen to the different perspectives, the different points of view, can you really make sense of it and understand it in depth. Now, one other thing that you were doing, particularly when there were two or three people working at the same time, they were sort of not quite observing each other, but being aware of each other. Also, as things were happening, we changed in the process. And this is another very powerful concept, which is called co-evolution. You're all familiar with the notion of evolution, but I want to introduce you to a much more powerful notion, which is co-evolution. Now, as you know, evolution always takes place within an ecosystem. In other words, there are other entities which are related to the thing we may be looking at, and they interact and influence each other. So if you think about this, particularly when we're working in any kind of group, what happens is that we influence each other. Now, if there is reciprocal influence, if really I influence you and in the process you influence me, and then we both change something in the way we behave, in the way we think, in the way we'll put up the string, and so on, that reciprocal influence that led to a change in behavior is called co-evolution. If the co is because it is reciprocal, it is not one way. If, of course, something changes in response to a change in its environment and it only changes one way, that is called adaptation. Now think about it, however. Anything that adapts, if we change our behavior because things around us are changing, that is not going to have no effect. Any change we actually make in order to adapt to things that are happening in our environment is going to influence that environment. It's going to influence those around us. It's going to influence those we work with, those we relate with. And so it is very rarely that adaptation stops at that point of just the one entity changing. It usually has that reciprocal effect, even though it may be longer term. Now, when we think about art and how artists work, that coevolutionary process, the co-evolutionary dynamics have been taking place over the centuries that art has been in existence, because artists are not only influenced by each other, they're also influenced with things that are happening in the broader environment. So when there are new inventions, particularly when new materials become available, they start to use them, they are influenced in their work. So this is another way of thinking of how that process, that creative process, takes place. Okay, so let me start to summarize. So I said, we start with connectivity and interdependence. Now, one of the things of interdependence is that if you have a very complex system that is intricately interdependent and you make a change in one part, you cannot always predict what effect is going to have in other parts of that system. So when the chancellor changes the interest rate, he hopes that certain things will happen, but he cannot predict precisely the effect it's going to have throughout the economy, and certainly not just the national economy, but the global economy. There's a lot that one can understand and explain in terms of, for example, the recent financial crisis, if one understands its complex nature and how the different interactions actually brought it about. So we talked about connectivity, interdependence, emergence. So emergence is the fact that you have both unpredictability and it's also systemic. In other words, it is how the system as a whole, the group as a whole, can create it. Individuals by themselves don't usually create it in that sense. We also talked about exploration of the space of possibilities. Which is exploring the different alternatives. And that comes into being, as I said, when there is a problem, when there is a constraint, when there is a perturbation. I also talked about co-evolution, which is how reciprocal influence actually changes the behavior of the interacting entities. Now, one other thing that Michael mentioned was self-organization. Now, self-organization is very important here. And when you asked the question, you said that we were doing groupthink. Yes, there is groupthink, that's part of it. But what is more interesting is how individuals will actually take an initiative and do something different.
But also, I was wondering, for example, if we had a room full of artists,
yes,
then each artist would most likely try to do something particularly spontaneous and original. So maybe one would decide to join their finger and their nose with a string,
yes,
and another would decide to join two of the glass and the water, and maybe someone else, or like one is joined to the air.
Uh-huh.
And so then maybe that's also somehow predictable in a way, or like being spontaneous. I don't know. I'm not
so
sure.
Are you trying to say that because they are used to breaking the rules?
Yeah, so it depends on the group or something.
It often depends. It can have some, the group can have some effect on it, but if this was happening over a long enough period, it wouldn't really make that much difference.
Mm-hmm.
But what is important is to appreciate and understand how either individuals or groups of individuals can work without being directed from outside that group. That is very important, and it's important to understand the fact that not everything needs to have central control. What this is telling us is that complex systems have the capacity, have the ability to actually work, that the individuals or groups can work independently, can work without someone actually telling them precisely what to do. And I'm sure that if I, you know, you'd have examples in all sorts of areas where this is happening. I've seen it even in factories where you would expect things to be very, very structured. Self-organization can also take place, where, for example, some people may see that there is a better way of doing a particular process, and they may then get together and decide to do it differently. But at no point has someone outside the group actually said, "This is what you need to do now." So this is a very important aspect of what complex systems actually are capable of doing. And of course, again, in terms of creativity and artistic process, this comes into it very, very much so. Now, none of this would happen without a system of feedback. So we need that constant information interaction to tell each other what is happening as we're communicating for it to happen. Without feedback, these processes simply would not happen. So feedback is a very important aspect of it. Now, there are quite a few other, these are just a few of the characteristics. The others you may be aware of is the fact that complex systems are nonlinear. And as we mentioned, they're multidimensional, and so on. So what I've done is I've just picked a few that are relevant, much more relevant to the artistic aspect, to perhaps help us think, first of all, a little bit differently, to just change our perspective of how we see the creative process, how we might be able to see art. But it is not confined only to art. This is just one example, because this happens to be the arts club, and I thought it might be interesting to actually take that as our starting point. But as I said, we use it in a very, very practical, day-to-day way of actually looking at very, very complex issues, complex problems in both the private and the public sector. So what I suggest now, we have a little sort of interaction between us and then open it up, because it would be great to just have your interaction. So,
What are the things that Eve has said before, which I find very, very helpful in terms of kind of understanding how complex systems work, is very similar in a way to what we're doing here, is to think about people crossing Trafalgar Square. They're going from one point to another in the square. Nobody tells you how to walk across the square. And yet, thousands of people don't run into each other. Okay, because they're a feedback situation. People are looking. You see each other. You move out of the way. You do all that sort of jiggly kind of thing, which we also are doing as we're kind of bobbing up and down in the room. And so that's a very complicated system with lots of people coming into it all the time. New members, and there's not even a rule, because nobody tells you don't run into somebody. You should just know that you shouldn't run into people when you cross the street or the square. So if you imagine the pattern that they're making as they're crossing, it becomes this very complex structure with this incredibly simple impetus, which is to in a way connect two points, i.e. where you started at one part of the square and where you left the square at the other part. And when I kind of understood that, I realized, oh, of course, that looks like a really simple thing, people crossing the square. And then when you start to imagine how you would model that mathematically, you cannot predict how you're going to walk across the square or I'm going to walk across the square. People are moving, people are coming in at all different times. You cannot predict what is an incredibly complicated pattern and can be quite a beautiful pattern, you know, if we were to kind of literally draw those lines as people came across it. And so it made it very clear to me how a very complex system works in my more or less everyday life, because I'm always, you know, if you're walking, you know, just coming out of the tube or what have you, you're interacting in these very complex ways. And what emerges from that are these patterns that we couldn't ever predict in a kind of a Newtonian sense. Like if I take this book and I drop it, we can predict it's going to fall, and we know how fast it's going to fall, and we can make predictions about its movement,
yeah.
But we can't make those predictions about how people move across Trafalgar Square. And so I that's something that's really kind of struck a chord with me, and that's not intended as a pun, but it influenced my thinking about how to make something that did that.
So can you predict that people will avoid obstacles, though? Because surely that's what's really going on.
Well, sometimes they don't. I mean, I'm sure you've been in a situation where you're like, you know, you both go to move out of the way and you still wind up bashing into each other.
That's where you get the feedback.
That's where you're getting a lot of feedback.
Right.
Yes.
That's right.
Yeah.
And if you don't avoid the obstacle and you get hurt, then you finally you decide you better look out next time and not just be looking at the fountain or whatever. You need to be looking where you're going. So there are certain behaviors that you can say most people are likely to avoid the obstacles. Most people are likely to walk in approximately straight lines, but not necessarily. I mean, you see people sort of zigzagging.
But my point is their zigzag, the randomness is
yes.
because of the need
well,
to
no, sometimes
obstacles.
People are incredibly random. I mean, you know, people are daydreaming, and you know, and women with or men with pushchairs who are not paying any attention. I've been run over any number of times. I'm sure many people have, or even in the supermarket. How many times have you been hit in the back with a shopping cart? You know, that completely, you know, they're not paying attention. And I think again, it's another situation where you cannot predict that. I mean, and I'm sure, especially with a shopping cart, you're not really trying to run into people, but.
So, Michael, as an artist, because we have been having a conversation sort of around these topics now for some time. So, as an artist, how can you give us some thoughts or insights for us to think about complexity theory in perhaps a more tangible way?
Well, I mean, I think that was a very interesting one. One of the other kind of emergence examples is how artists self-organize themselves into groups. So, like the YBA, pretty much everybody knows what the Young British Artists. I mean, this is again, you know, these are groups of people who were at different schools. They weren't all at Goldsmiths, but they sort of found each other. They organized things. They created a whole new school, in a way, of work, which didn't exist before. And there was no, I mean, there may have been some kind of uber-guiding notion by Michael Craig Martin that they should be professional, but he didn't actually oversee their careers or anything like that. There was no kind of Machiavelli kind of principle, but the artists got together. I'm a generation before that, and the those of you who are familiar with the term installation art, I hope most of you are, I mean, that's a generation of work that I come from. And one of the reasons that I wrote the books on installation art is because people kept saying to me, what is installation art? And I kept trying to explain it. I thought, you know, I think I need to write a book because it emerged from on a very global scale, and both of those books are global investigations in it, and it was something that came up out of the practice of artists making work with it, and it was amazing that it happened all over the world, and generally in I now understand that a lot of that comes out of an economic situation, because it came in the early 80s, the late 70s, out of the last major economic downturn, where artists were, you know, didn't have money, they were looking to, you know, to make projects. and there weren't spaces, there wasn't government funding, so they were taking over factories and derelict sites and making installations that were time-based, which at the end of them they were finished. And so again, there was nobody directing us to do that. You know, we just did it. And I came from New York. I met people here who were doing that, and decided to stay. And met people in Germany who were doing it. I mean, and just all over. And the connectivity, and the feedback that came out of that was that there was a whole global group of people who wound up making what we now call installation art, which at the time we didn't even have a name for it. I mean, we did not know what it was. I mean, there was, you know, it was like sculpture art. I mean, you know, and slowly this notion of installation art emerged as a property or a category within fine art, and then it took a certain amount of time for it to be able for us to see the pattern of it and actually name it and call it installation art.
But what happened during that process? Did people actually influence each other and change in that process?
Oh, absolutely, because the people who were going to see those shows were mainly other artists. I mean, you know, if you imagine, you know, it's a derelict factory in what would say Canary Wharf. Now Canary Wharf is a gleaming space. In those times, it was literally a derelict factory, and you were not going to get the likes of Charles Saatchi to go out there and look at it. Okay, you only got other artists to go out there, and so you would have events, and you would talk, and it was all about in that sense, like-minded people looking and making things. I mean, we see this historically when we look at Impressionism, or when we look at Dadaism. You know, you're like-minded people who want to do something that is actually different from what the norm is, and they find that the only way that they can show their work is that they self-organize and they create the Salon des Refuses, you know,
yes,
in Paris, or those kinds of exhibitions where people say, well, you don't want to see it, well, I'll make it, I'll do it. We're going to put this together, we make this exhibition, and if you want to come, you can come, if you don't, what have you. And then eventually it becomes part of a longer process of fine art.
Yes. Now, a lot of people usually ask, you know, what's the point of all this? You know, why should I need to know about all these concepts and ideas that, you know, you're introducing to me that I need to learn and so on? What we find actually is that, and this time I need to speak much more about people in organizations, in business and so on, rather than art. To make more sense, because that's where most of my research has been, is that very good managers intuitively actually use these principles. But the moment they understand that there is a solid theory underneath what they think is just their intuition, it actually makes a lot more sense. So instead of them saying, oh, you know, it's just my intuition, and sometimes they describe it as, you know, I feel like someone sort of groping in the dark, and then it provides a light, it provides an explanatory framework, it provides something where they can actually make sense of the phenomena they are experiencing, they are seeing, and yet they think it's just, as I said, intuition, or it's just it happens to be, you know, fairly random, but which it isn't. So actually understanding what happens, how these organizations as complex systems actually behave, makes a great deal of difference to them. And I think the same happened. I mean, as I said, we've been having a discussion of a similar type for many years, and I think, Michael, you've probably found that thinking about these concepts has made a shift in your own perspective, because I notice now you use the concepts quite comfortably.
Well, and also, I realized that I was already doing this. It's exactly what Eve is saying. From a curatorial position, I'm looking at work all the time, and I'm making decisions about which work works together You know, because if you're making a show, trying to put together something that has a theme or perhaps a statement, or you see an emerging trend among artists and you say, wow, that's an interesting emerging new school. How did that happen? I mean, what many of you may be aware of, like this whole East German Leipzig group of painters who are recently, you know, been the rage, and you know, and they came out of East Germany and kind of, again, it's sort of very figurative, which came out of a very strange situation where, you know, abstract work and installation was absolutely the kind of the norm, and then all of a sudden this very figurative painting emerged. And in some ways as a reaction to the other, but you know, if you're making if you're making a show, if you're curating something, you have to be aware of those things. And so I've actually, in some very small ways, started to use it in my own work, and in a way to give up power. I mean, that sounds kind of strange, but I brought a catalog of a project that I just did last year. Many of you will know that Liverpool was one of two European cities of culture last year. You probably don't know that Stavanger in Norway was the other. Stavanger was very good about publicizing Liverpool, but Liverpool seemed not to return the favor. They invited six artists from around the world, and they gave each of us a lighthouse to do a project, anything we wanted. And my project is called Golden Rain, and I'll let you look at it, but I'll just show you my lighthouse, which was a huge six-story lighthouse. And I really thought it was a very interesting kind of thing, but at the same time, I also wanted to interact with other people, with other artists. So I asked the organizers if it was possible for me to invite other artists to work with me. So I self-organized another show in a way within that show. And so the actual project, which is called Golden Rain, there are 100 of these lead crystal kind of teardrop shapes, and each of them is about this big, and they're mirrored so you can't see inside them. Each of them have a work of art in them that was given to me by another artist from around the world. And so the second part of the catalog shows actually all the other, all the objects that are inside the bottles. And again, I didn't tell them what to do. I didn't even say it had to be about, the story is based on Dione, who Zeus was so in love with her, that her father, who was the king of Argos, put her in a tower by the sea, and the only way he could get in was to turn himself into rain and pour through the grate of the window, and then she, of course, became pregnant. There's sort of these golden teardrops or what have you. And it's a very interesting myth, and I deal with that. But I didn't say to people, you must make a piece about Dione and Zeus. I simply said, this is the project, this is what I'm doing, and I would like you to put some, you know, give me an artwork to put inside the wall, whatever you want. And then it's very interesting what people did do. And when you look through the 100 different objects, different themes emerge, which I didn't tell people. So there's some things that were, because the story deals with Dione and her father, who goes to kill her by putting her and the child in a wooden chest and throws her into the sea to drown. There's a lot of work about, there are a lot of pieces that are about the relationship between an artist and their father. She was in love with there's also a lot of pieces about the relationship between that artist and their lovers in kind of the classical sense of the story. There are actually pieces about the lighthouses that come out. There's so many interesting kind of things that emerge, which I really didn't tell them in any way that you know what you had to do, what you should put in. And so it was a very, for me, it was a very interesting thing. And when one reads the book, you actually can see those themes emerging. And again, they were completely self-organized in the sense that people chose to make those decisions about what they put in.
Do you think that they did choose, or do you think that it emerged for them? I mean, that's the thing, because you're making it sound as if the art was that somebody did actually then make the decision, I'm going to relate to, you know, the relationship with the father or something like that. But do you not think that probably the emergence was happening? And retrospectively, you can look back at it and say that these are the themes. But
that's what I'm saying. I am saying it's retrospectively, because they didn't know what anyone else had done.
No, but even for the artists themselves, do you think that they actually, because this is a slight problem that I have when I make art, that people say, what is it about? But it seems to be something that emerges as you're making it,
sure.
And then you can stand and look back. So then you wonder if this is kind of like a bit of a Russian doll that something is emerging from them as
yeah.
they are making it.
I'm sure that's true,
yeah.
because a lot of people, a lot of the artists who did
yeah.
this spoke almost about that and how that they would make something and then they actually decided to make something else
yeah.
and they changed it and it kept changing and then eventually they came to a piece that they decided they did want.
But they recognised as what they wanted.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. What's interesting, what you've just described, is that in retrospect you can trace the path, but at any point where you need to make a decision, it is not a single predetermined decision, because if you have even one alternative, again, it opens up the options for you. So at every decision point, you had to, I mean, even if we're talking about decision points, it means that there were more than one options open to you. Because if the whole thing had been predetermined, you would have known at the beginning what the artwork would look like.
Yeah.
As I said, in retrospect, you can certainly trace it, but going forward, you can't. Because at every point, as I said, you have options and it opens and you start getting the non-linearities. So that is, you just described that
but
process.
The assumption always seems to be that you could say at the beginning, I mean, there almost seems to be a sort of sleight of hand which requires artists to say, this is what I set out to do. Whereas in fact,
yeah.
I think probably every when you listen to people talking about how it started, it's more
yeah.
as you just
yeah. Yesterday, I was at a friend's house, and she's an artist,
mm-hmm.
and we were admiring a head that she had created from clay, and it was a head with an enormous sort of headdress, a sort of African one. And then she explained that it started off by being a bust, not just a head, but somehow when she created the headdress, the whole thing did not balance. And she had to actually cut it off at the base of the neck, because that then provided the right balance, while at chest level, it simply didn't. And yet she started off building it, you know, from chest level up. So she, until the end, she did not know that this was going to be just a head with a headdress.
Mm.
And I think that's part of the process.
Are you sort of saying then, probably to get the best kind of art that we want, it should all be a collaborative process? I mean, you're talking about the young British artists. They're very much individuals making very individual work. It's very hard to see really how they relate. But if you have, you know, if you're an artist working on your own, okay, there are lots of inferences. And as you say, you make decisions on your own. But is there not a case based on complexity theory that artists of all kinds should work in little groups and produce
yes.
individual works,
actually,
just like we did tonight?
Yeah, interestingly enough, we try to put together a project on collaborative creation,
yeah.
Because for that very reason.
Well, just
and
what Michael did, which
yeah.
sounds wonderful.
Exactly.
And it's collaborative,
yes.
genuinely collaborative, based on complexity theory.
Yes. And quite a lot of people are doing it. I don't know if you come across the Florence Trust, anyone?
Yes.
Well, you know then that artists are provided with a space for 12 months and they work together, not necessarily as a group. What is very interesting is that when they start off at the beginning of the year, they put up barriers. They will bring screens or put up curtains or whatever to separate their work from everybody else. Some point through that as they go along, they start taking the barriers down, they start interacting, because they find that by having that interaction, their work actually benefits. Until by the end of the year, they are beginning to work together. They may not be creating one collaborative artwork, they're all creating their own works, but nevertheless, they are influencing each other and getting a lot out through that interaction.
I mean, could you collaboratively write a novel?
Yeah.
For example, I mean, you're talking about factory floors, you know, and perhaps making a car,
yeah,
as they do in Sweden, collaboratively.
Oh, yes.
But could you, do you think, based on this theory, write a novel? Or some of the more, you know, complex individual things that people do individually, could it be done, do you think, by a group, a small group of people?
Well, most films are
yes,
written by about
films.
50
exactly.
people
yes.
these days,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And certainly TV is, you know, it's millions of writers.
Yes,
you know.
Yes. Or yeah, comedy.
Yes, yes. Oh. But a lot of the films, theatre, opera, and so these are all collaborative works of art. But to come back to you, to actually write a novel. Collaborative. I think there have been there have been some experiments, but perhaps there are some aspects where the individual author needs to work it through by themselves. But there's no reason why not.
But are we saying then that complexity theory always has successful and benign outcomes?
No. No.
I mean, but how would a children's nursery look if complexity theory was applied? How would the parent? Would the parents be okay when they arrive to collect their kids? So, is it always a better system?
Okay, you've asked two questions there.
Yes.
First of all, is it benign? No, it isn't. In fact, it doesn't have a specific value. It does not say it is better to do this than to do that. And you can use it in the exact opposite way, and you can use it to actually. In fact, if you use this concept as a criminal, you would be a very successful criminal. And so it is not always benign. And very often we have emergent properties that are precisely what we don't want. So when we talk about unintended consequences of these consequences being undesirable, that's precisely what is happening. So let's come back to your second point about a nursery.
Complexity versus chaos, I suppose. at what point complexity theory breaks down and becomes chaos?
Ah, all right. Let me then draw you a little diagram. It is not complexity theory breaking into chaos. It is what often happens. There are three very broad regions. One is where you have stability, when you have a very stable state. You then have the other extreme, which is a chaotic state, where everything is totally random. But in between, this is the area of complexity, where you have order, and at the same time, you do not have total structure. So you have both. At the same time, you have a great degree of uncertainty and unpredictability, but you also have order and pattern existing at the same time. And this is what complexity is about in that state. So this is where you have complex behavior. And these things here, these are the phase transitions, where they move from one to the other. Does that make sense?
It makes total. That's very expressed. Yeah. So the possibilities of greatness is in the centre.
Yeah.
So a nursery actually usually will occupy that central ground.
Yes.
It'll be like controlled, but with random.
Exactly. If it was totally chaotic, it couldn't work very well.
It would be more fun.
Yes, you.
Coming back to this, it's a deeper crossing about Trafalgar.
Oh yes.
Is it complex or chaotic?
Oh, I think it is a complex because there is order as well as uncertainty in what they're doing. It both exist at the same time. If it was totally chaotic, then we would be bumping
along, you know, with each other, as well as avoiding each other. But you find that most people don't bump into each other. They are, there is some order within what appears to be random behavior.
I don't know whether they bump or not, but I, if I look at them from the above,
yes,
I will see that the trajectory which they follow is absolutely bizarre.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they are just trying to avoid bumping.
Yes.
I don't
yes.
know. But it's so complex that maybe it's already chaotic.
Although isn't it much like an anthill, where there's, if you look at an anthill, you know, things sort of kind of make sense, but if you drop something into the middle of the anthill, you know,
mm-hmm.
you dropped a bomb on the square, then you would see chaos,
mm-hmm.
I would suspect.
Actually, not necessarily.
No. Okay.
Not necessarily, because you may initially, people not know what is happening, what to do, very, very quickly,
right.
they
yeah.
will reestablish a new order, because in order to survive, you have to collaborate, you have to do certain things, you have to scramble out of whatever.
Mm-hmm.
We've been looking at the effects of 7/7 and the evacuation from that, and it's quite astonishing how very little panic there actually was. It was a changed state. It was something totally different, something that no one expected when they, you know, went on that train. But fairly quickly, they actually started helping each other and doing things in order to stay alive. That was not chaotic.
So
that
is
was
chaos,
not random.
Does
yeah.
chaos tend to be a temporary state, and it tends to go back through complexity into stability? Is that?
Oh, you can have a constant movement between them.
Mm.
None of these remain static all the time.
Mm.
They move through the different states. Now, there was somebody over
is
here, actually.
When you have
say,
the incident like 7/7, there is a sort of split second whereupon there is total silence, and
yes.
people have that slight second break. Then people go into,
yes.
shall I say, automatic mode, and that's what stops total chaos. It is a natural human thing.
Yes.
It stops people just move, don't they? You don't know what you are doing, but you just do something, and that is becoming you become automatic, don't you? That's why you don't get total chaos always.
By automatic, you mean that
people start moving, they start thinking, I have to get away. They are subconsciously thinking about, I have to walk away and get away.
Yes.
That's why you must try and not have, that's why if somebody does fall over, you can cause chaos.
Yes.
That is when the problem occurs, when one person does something
yeah.
that nobody else is doing. That's when chaos comes
sometimes
in.
Sometimes it does. But what was interesting was how often what may be the primary instinct is, I have to survive. And yet how many people, instead of getting out, stopped to help someone else? It happened time and time and time and time again. So that was another, you know, quite strong phenomenon. Yes. Yes.
I'm interested in the application of the theory.
Yeah.
Onto how organisations are traditionally thought of as working,
yes.
i.e. the pyramid structure,
yes.
the structure with the boss at the top, and not just workplaces, but that you have somebody up here who delegates power
yeah.
to a raft of people who then, it seems to me that this, I don't know, how does it work? Like, does it work like a
yeah.
revolution within?
What happened, in fact, these kinds of organisations, particularly they're very hierarchical, bureaucratic organisations, all have some of this within it. But the more effective organizations, we found, in fact, don't work in a very hierarchical, pyramidal way for several reasons. One is that any and every organization has a lot of very intelligent people within it. They have what we call distributed intelligence. It does not reside at the top. Very rarely is it just the CEO or the board of directors that have all the intelligence or the good ideas. In fact, it is throughout the organization. And once they've realized this is what actually is the case, and they start taking advantage of that distributed intelligence, you begin to actually relinquish central top control. That's one aspect. The other is very large, complex global organizations find that it's becoming more and more difficult to control a very large global organization from the center because you have huge variations throughout the world. And again, what they've discovered is that by allowing the local groups to a degree of self-organization, a degree of diversity, they do a lot better than imposing one standard that is the same throughout, because what may be right for the UK may be totally wrong in Japan or whatever. And they're beginning now to understand these things, and they're really effective organizations are doing it. So these are just two reasons why the power structures are actually changing. Because in order to actually have an effective organization, you need to change those relationships and those power structures. And that's a very brief one. It's an awful lot we can actually talk about. But once, and the other idea here, what we've been working with is that you don't impose from the top down on an organization how and what needs to be done. You create what we call an enabling environment, and this is where you need to understand that that has to be multidimensional, that you have to address the social, the political, the cultural, the physical, the technical, all those aspects. If you think of that and creating that environment which facilitates the individuals and the groups to actually do their work better, you get a lot more out of it. And that applies to any size organization. It's just that the very large global ones find it much more difficult if they are centrally controlled. So this idea of an enabling environment is a very powerful one, and this is what we've been working with a lot of organizations to create.
And that's what we try to do at the Royal Academy School.
Yeah.
How about Damien Hirst?
Yeah.
He's got a whole gang of people working for him. He doesn't do it all himself.
No,
he's got about 100 people who work for him.
Is it as many as that?
No, I hear he has layoffs.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay,
there were some questions.
Yeah. Yes, it just seems to me that a lot of this is at odds with a lot of our culture, where we look for charismatic, supremely gifted people, possibly headhunted for an organization, or in art someone who is the absolute sort of quintessence of a certain movement. This does seem a little bit at odds with the sort of sharing kind of mutuality that you're describing.
Okay, not entirely, because you cannot have a world which is homogeneous. You're bound to have your geniuses and your charismatic people and your great artists and so on. I think this is part of the diversity and part of the fact that you have to have the whole range, not just that sort of homogeneous middle. So you need to have that balance. Otherwise, we are doomed in a way if we are all sort of gravitate to a sort of homogeneous middle level. Don't you think? That we need the geniuses and the charismatic people.
Well, I think we hear so much about that, that it dominates so much of our culture, that we sort of give up in face of this so-called superior talent.
Yes.
How many people could be bankers, Are there really only half a dozen who are really good, and so on?
Oh, exactly, exactly. But I wouldn't call bankers particularly put them in that particular
category.
But I mean, I think
if we look at
the art world, it's an interesting thing in that we at the Royal Academy schools are we're not. I mean, it's great if the students go on to be very well considered and very highly paid, but that's not what our job is. Our job is to help them become as good an artist that they can be. And I think that's really the role of any educator, wherever you may be. And what I think is very interesting, and again, I think this has a lot to do with the web, you know, is that people are actually connecting and actually doing things in a totally totally new way, which none of us really are going to know the results of that for another 10, 20 years, or maybe even further. And there really is when I came to London in 1981, I came because I actually was very unhappy with the New York art world, which was very much about exactly what you're talking about, you know, Julian Schnabel and, you know, the people, you know, not having a community and actually wanting, you know, to be these art stars. And I actually wanted to work in very collaborative ways. And there, in America, there were really no opportunities to do that. Whereas when I came to England, when I went to Germany, went to all throughout Europe, that was a model that, again, nobody thought of it as a model, but that's actually what was going on. People were working in that way. And I've stayed here for 30 years because it's actually a way of making art that I personally find fulfilling. I am now seeing people come back to that because I think the notion, and going back to the whole thing about YBA, is, okay, well, they didn't make work together. They were making work within various studios, and they were talking to each other and marrying each other and divorcing each other. And they were actually always talking about art, or at least at the beginning. Now they only talk about money. But when it was very interesting was when they were talking about art and they were conceiving of new ways of making work. And I think that is always the case, is that artists come together because they're looking for that interaction. I think at certain points they can be detached from a greater artistic community, and, you know, and then they lose that feedback, you know. And I mean, a perfect example of that is someone like Madonna. I mean, you know, nobody would say no to her. Or Michael Jackson. I mean, you know, that no doctors are jacking him up with drugs because nobody knows how to say no to him, you know, because he's so detached. And his artwork, i.e. his music, completely suffered because he made rubbish music for the last sort of 10, 15 years. I mean, I don't know how much you like Michael Jackson, it doesn't really matter. But the point that I'm making is there was a point when he was the best musician, I mean, the best pop musician in the world, and then as he got more out of the loop of interacting with other musicians, he simply became this isolated person who simply had no proper feedback. You know, the whole notion of the yes man, you know, is not really feedback. You know, and then you don't make good decisions. Whether you're an artist, whether you're a singer, whether you're Bernie Madoff, you know, you have to be in a situation where people give you that feedback. And younger artists are not interested in Charles Saatchi. It's very interesting. I mean, we have a very different kind of group of kids coming through. And they're like, ugh, I would never let such a bono work. You know, they're not interested in it. You know, things change. I mean, that of course is one of the most interesting things about the art world and why it's very unpredictable. It is that, you know, it's always changing.
Okay. Yes.
Something I find fascinating about all of this is that at the end of the day, all of this is based on a finite set of rules. So you have apparent chaoticness, but the universe is based on a finite set of rules. So you have a finite set of capabilities. We all have different capabilities. We come together, we put them in a different way, and something different might emerge, but it's still finite. So we're creating all this apparent newness out of something, a limited resource, if you like. And I was just wondering if you're trying to model this, because it's very similar to my mind to fractal geometry. And the Mandelbrot set.
Yes.
You know, clouds appear chaotic, but they are based on a very, very finite model. So you have this incredible complexity and beauty of the geography of the whole world.
Exactly.
So is this something that you're modelling? Because it sounds very much to me like something that's based on circles. You know, you have little circles, our own circle, we're a circle of one, and we get into circle three, and there's effective circles of eight, aren't they, or ten, or something like that. And you have circles within circles and a bigger circle. And then you still have the hierarchy there, because at the end of the day, somebody is responsible for looking after all those groups. So is it something you're modelling?
Okay, several questions there. First of all, the Mandelbrot said, and that is part of chaos theory. Chaos theory is not exactly the same as complexity, but it's part of it.
Yeah.
So complexity is a lot more than chaos theory. And I don't usually like to talk about simple and finite rules, because a complex world can make new rules and can create new forms of behavior, new forms of interaction. I don't think they are finite. Now, what is your other point?
About modeling.
Oh, the modeling. The modeling. Yes. There's an awful lot of work around the world to try and model complex systems. Complex systems, anything from the internet to human organizations, to in fact, we're trying now to model evacuation processes and so on. The problem here, if you really are going to model it realistically, is the sheer diversity of behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Because even though you have patterns of behavior, if you're trying to model individual agents, and one of the tools for modeling is called agent-based modeling, where you actually have heterogeneity, you have the differences between your interacting agents. Now, that is very, very difficult. And as I said, some of the best brains in the world at the moment are working on that. So there's an awful lot of modeling that is happening. Yes, absolutely. Any other one? Because we're nearly there, yeah? Anyone else dying to say something?
One
yes.
More question. I was wondering if complexity theory creates like new rules at different times, then I was wondering if like you might talk about particular periods in history when you would consider that to be an interesting moment for complexity theory, or so that.
Not necessarily. I think if you think of the process of, you know, the historical process, you can see it, you can explain the phenomena of history using insights from complexity theory. You can explain what happens by using the theory. So you can't just say that a particular time you can apply it and at other times you can't.
But surely there are certain circumstances that facilitate it more effectively than others, and as a result, or suppress it. No?
Yes.
Is that stupid?
Are you trying to think that, you know, in some cases things are so simple that you don't need something like complex theory to explain them? What is it that you're trying to distinguish here?
Well, I suppose that if you're in a suppressed society, then maybe there are certain constrictions which result in the impossibility.
Oh, I see.
Or the other way around. That creates the beginning of people maybe reacting against that is the other possibility.
Okay, this is very interesting. I've just come back from Slovakia. They had 40 years of communist rule. And after the Velvet Revolution, when you know they split from the Czech Republic and Slovakia, it was fascinating. A revolution would not have taken place if you had completely dumped down all these characteristics. The control was there. The communist regime tried to control that society. It was successful for 40 years, but it did not continue forever. So that change happened, and it happened, and then things became changed. But everything, what is interesting is that even though we see such a change at a particular point in time, so there is a date when the Velvet Revolution happened, it did not just happen. There were an awful lot of things happening at the micro level throughout that suddenly could not have been contained, and then it becomes visible. But it doesn't just happen out of the blue. You have the process happening at a micro level all the time, and then it jumps and you see the new structure at the great, you know, at the macro level. But you cannot explain, you can explain it in terms of trying to control it, but you can't explain it in terms of being simple. No society is ever simple. Once people interact, once individuals interact, you start getting complex behavior.
But it's an argument for free society, one would imagine. But the freer societies are the ones that give rise to greater creativity.
Yes. It does, and at the same time, the amount of creativity that, you know, is underground that still happens. You cannot put the stopper on the bottle forever. It will eventually,
It's a very perverse notion of creativity, but I mean, if we look at North Korea, there's an immense amount of creative energy spent keeping those people inside North Korea. Okay, I mean it's what Eve was saying, you know, that you can look at the perverse notion of how this functions, because you know those people are very buttoned down. They do not have interaction. I mean, individual people in North Korea do not have interaction. I literally just met a Korean person 2 days ago who just come back from North Korea because she was Korean and was able to meet family, and was, you know, it is as awful as it is as represented. I mean, you know, it really is stopped down. But how do you do that when people are trying to do other things and make their lives? You really have to use a lot of creative energy to actually stop people, you know, and close them down. And you know, the latest thing is that they've now banned the word hamburger because it's a Western idea. So one has ground meat between bread slices. And you know, I mean, that's really creative, and it's mad. I mean, you know, or the French not liking, you know, the word le week-end, you know, and officially banning that from the French language. It's not in the Académie Française. You know, so you cannot say that we can officially in French.
Yeah, but the creative process and the diversity will bubble up.
Yeah.
So it's like saying in your Trafalgar Square example that everyone, from whichever point they enter the square to whichever point they're going to leave, it must walk in a clockwise direction.
That's right.
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you very
much,
everyone. I would just like to take a picture of everyone because we have that for our...
And the wire, so they
and
get the wire.
Yes, I'm trying to get both, actually.
It's going to be really impossible in here.
I know. Okay. The wires?
I'd like to thank Michael and Eve very much on behalf of the club, and hopefully everyone who enjoyed this conversation tonight, for making time and sharing the expertise. I don't know what you all took away, but for me, it was a kind of visual and historical feast from Michael, from, you know, Schnabel to YBA to Leo Rausch to your Lighthouse projects and the string projects and Calabria and Turin and so much. And for yourself, the contextualization in terms of stability and chaos theory, as well as putting it in the place of, you know, the Velvet Revolution in 77. It's just been fascinating at Trafalgar Square. So it's just in collaboration so much, I'm like overwhelmed. So I'm going to decamp to the bar to dinner, but hopefully I'll get to see you upstairs.
Yes,
but really,
absolutely.
It's just been so informative. I didn't know any of what to expect. It's just been great. So thank you for making the time.
Okay. Pleasure.
Really.
If anyone wants to look, I'll leave these up here. I would say they're slightly more, they're not very traditional, but they're more traditional than this sort of thing, works of mine, just so you can see what sort of works that
Michael.
I do. Yeah. So I often work very collaboratively in the sense that I work with glass, and I don't blow the glass, but I design the glass, and I work with the glass blowers in the factory. And it is, again, it's a very complex thing because we're having to do... I'm a lot of complex negotiations to get those pieces.